Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. Our top 10 data-related articles and blog posts from the past week, all in 30 minutes, or sometimes longer, depending on how much we are drinking. As always, links to all the articles we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter, at @partiallyd. My name is Chris Albin, and with me today is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan. First things first, booze. I am drinking a wonderful michelada, which I made for this, which is, if you don't know, a mix of salt, clamato juice, and a lot of spices with cheap beer. It's amazing on a summer day, and I'm really enjoying it. Jonathan, what are you drinking?
Well, thank you, Chris, for that description of your nice seasonal beverage as, like, every state in the nation drops into freezing temperatures. I am drinking an Omission, a handcrafted lager, but I love the reason that I picked it is because I have to read you the tagline. It's very cool. It says, "It isn't just what we took out, it's what we left in."
Absolutely.
Omission lager. It's hot. It's really tasty. I love it.
Left in the alcohol. That's what we're all hoping.
All right. Now that we've been drinking, we should totally do some stuff. All right. So let's actually, for real. We should talk about some data stuff.
We should. Absolutely. All right. Story number one goes to you.
Yeah, story number one. So this is probably something that everybody read this week because it was so awesome. It was on like every blog that's ever been blogged in the universe. But it's about how Google used machine learning. They used a neural network to automatically caption images. So like this is a thing, right? So they didn't. Everybody kind of remembers probably the neural network that a billion, whatever, not a billion, but like 16,000 nodes, like a massive neural network that taught itself the content of an image. It like saw an image of a cat and it came up with the concept of a cat based on having read that, having seen that image. Like it's amazing, right? Like it's like a brain. But the Jordan Pearson at Motherboard, which is where I found the story, had like a really cool perspective on it and basically drew the connection between not just the image recognition, which is super impressive, data science and machine learning work, but also to the sentence construction, the natural language processing. So the neural network that can take concepts and form like a human sentence, like something that feels like natural language, what a human would say. And so the cool thing was that they took these two massive neural networks and connected them. So there was the image recognition, and then that output was fed to the second neural network that took those concepts and put it into a sentence, which is cool. Like, it just sort of dramatically expands the possibilities when we can start to combine these great big neural networks. So that was cool. Props to Google. I was into it.
No.
How about you? I think everybody was, right?
This is one of those things, though. I love the fact that they take two different systems and connected them. And I know that seems kind of, that seems kind of standard, like people always do that, but it's not actually the case. Like a lot of us write runoff scripts and which don't connect to each other, or even runoff analyses that don't connect to each other. But it was, it's really cool to see something that is a large system feeding into another large system to do something that we never thought would be, possible a few years ago. I think it's awesome. I am totally game. I want to feed it a bunch of images and see what happens.
the cool thing, just to dovetail this, is that it represents the beginning of something much greater, right? Because this idea that two neural networks that were designed for different purposes can be connected, right? That's sort of an inherent property of a neural network, that they're fairly modular. So if you start to think of how might we start thinking of neural networks like Legos, like building blocks, and we could string them together to generate interesting outputs, it's kind of mind-boggling, right? It's really exciting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is awesome stuff. I want to see more of it in the future. So now on a less note, story number two, how to lie with indices.
Number two.
So Darren Huff in 1954 wrote something called How to Lie with Statistics. It is a very famous book if you deal with statistics. Probably everyone's read it. It's pretty awesome. But we're seeing a new sort of lying with statistics in the form of performance indices. What is a performance indice?
What is a performance indice?
Well, let me tell you in a very, a very nice and concise way. A performance indice is typically measuring a large social phenomenon, let's say global poverty or gender inequality or something like that, using a large number of variables and reducing it down to a single number. There's a lot of promise behind this with the idea of, okay, well, I can finally understand what is happening. I just look at this number, and if the number's going in the direction that I want, that means that I'm making progress in whatever thing it is. The problem is that with these performance indices, it is so easy to either unintentionally change what the output is going to be, or to, in the worst case scenario, lie, right? So you're
sure, or just make things up.
You know, I mean, you can imagine a scenario where you have this indice that takes 20 different variables and puts them into one, you know, one number through some kind of algorithm, through some kind of process. It's really, really tempting, I'm sure, if your company is based on this or your organization is based on this, to take this number and say, hey, well, let's weight this one a little bit more than this other one, or let's take this kind of data and log it or something like that. And, you know, in a way that is classic economist who wrote the article, this, you know, you could see this great takedown of the stuff that of these kind of performance indices. And it is really cool to see. I really appreciated the fact that, you know, they're not hyped as this great way of measuring these large social phenomenons, but they're actually a way for people to say what they want to say, even if that's not entirely the truth.
Oh, it's interesting. So, like, basically, the process by which these indicators are selected, right? So if I want to choose a performance index, that's a subjective process. That's what you're saying. So, like, let's say that there were 20 indicators that I think are related to the economic health of a region of a particular country. I choose those indicators myself based on my expertise and or, according to this article, my personal desires, right? Like that's what you're saying. It's not like an algorithm picks these based on what seemed to be a best fit for the model or whatever.
No, absolutely not. This is entirely, you know, driven by the user. And I think the way to think about this is that the value of the indice is not so much based on the raw data that's coming in, so much as the choice of the creator of that indice. And that's why it's so important that we're looking at these numbers thinking that they are objective when they are entirely based on subjective things, which, you know, it's a great point for the economist to make, and I'm happy to see that it's being made.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that kind of bias is important. It's important to point out, for sure, especially when you're working on important things, like, number three, basketball. So, number three, the third story that we want to talk about, thanks to my graceful segue, is that Harvard researchers are doing big data on the NBA, like big data on professional basketball, which is super cool. So Mark McCluskey did a whole sort of breakdown of this approach on Wired. There's a great video. We'll put the link to it on the website, yada, yada, yada. But basically, it's kind of a follow-on from the way that we have started to become accustomed to big data being used in sports, right? So there's the canonical example probably of Moneyball, right? That Michael Lewis book where he talked about all of the statistics that were being used to drive baseball team, the management of baseball teams. And so they started to discover all sorts of interesting things about the way that baseball's really played and the data that leads to teams winning. And it was often different than the intuition of people who've been around the game for a long time. Great. It's like a classic data science win. But what's cool about basketball is that, like, so you take a game like baseball where everything is sort of based on people in fixed positions taking discrete actions. So it's a great use case for sort of quant stuff, right? Because you have very measurable discrete actions that then you can use to do some kind of quantitative analysis. Awesome. But basketball is super fluid, right? So everything depends on, like, this very variable position of the players in space and time, and the position relative to other players matters, and it's sort of infinitely more complex and fluid and dynamic. And what's exciting is that they've taken something like mapping and drilled it down to a really small scale, like a basketball court, and started to assign values to different actions that players can take at certain points in the game. It's super cool. It's a lot more information than you would need to analyze and assess with something like baseball, but it in fact actually will probably revolutionize that game in the same way that Moneyball revolutionized baseball. It's super cool.
Now, this article is so important, and this project is, you know, exactly the kind of stuff that I want to see. You know, we see in data science these two different approaches where people look at stuff that's being made from, let's say, baseball statistics, sabermetrics, and that kind of thing, and they say, oh, well, we can apply this to, you know, politics in Rwanda, or maybe a, you know, business development in China or something like that.
Of course you can.
Yeah.
Of course you can.
And the difference is that baseball is a game that was designed around, I mean, it is almost as if it was designed for statistics. It is a, you know, it was designed to be spoken over the radio. It is perfect for doing statistics on, but a lot of sports are way more fluid. And this advancement going from, let's say, baseball, which was, you know, because there's those set bases and because you can describe it so easily, going from that sort of set to something that's way more fluid is the stuff that I want to see, because you can take the stuff that we've learned from, let's say, working in basketball and then apply that into these other more fluid social dynamics, let's say poverty overseas or a business in China or whatever you want to do. That stuff is super cool. I love this kind of stuff. I hope they do, you know, I hope they do way more of it, but I also hope they kind of present their results to everyone else so I can steal how they've figured it out. But I'm, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can steal it. I can steal it. Maybe I will kick some more ass in my fantasy league. Like that's
and your, let alone your fantasy league. It's really your pickup basketball game that you really, you can really use data to improve upon.
That's true. I am totally going to kick everybody in the neighborhood's ass because I'm using data science to decide from which point on the court I should be taking my shots. That's totally genius. I mean, yeah. Geopolitical crisis, that'd be fine. You know, the economy in China, sure. But let's make sure that we focus on the important things.
Neighborhood basketball games.
Neighborhood basketball. I'll just keep drinking. You move along.
All right.
Go on to the next story.
Story number four, trust the algorithms, not the data. This comes from Justin Washtell, who posted a blog post on Analytics Bridge. Justin walks through a story with a really puzzling problem. So he had a client who had millions of records, and each record was quote-unquote ground-truthed by a human expert. And his role was to apply a machine learning algorithm. But he found that the results really sucked, right? They were not what you would think. So he ended up going back and taking a teeny subset of the data, and he found that the problem wasn't his algorithm, or, you know, frankly, in this case, it was just the machine learning algorithm that would happened out of the box, but rather that the horrible ground truth data, right? So what was being categorized in a way that didn't make any sense. The problem was absolutely with these human experts rather than the math. And I love this idea. I really, as soon as I saw this, I wanted to bring it up because people say all the time, in fact, Justin even mentions this in his blog post, that people say, trust the data, trust the data. Let me tell you, never trust the data. The data is trying to lie to you. There is some portion of the data that is wrong. It is messy. It is dirty. And even when you think it's clean, there's something weird that's happening to it. Real world data is insanely dirty. And even if you go look at it, you know, there's many ways to describe this. People call it the code book or the data dictionary or the metadata around a data set. But whatever that is not the data, right? The user manual for the data is not the data set. And it is so important to take this data and actually understand what's happening. Look at the variables. Take summary statistics, do an exploratory analysis, and see, you know, if let's say you're tracking the, you know, let's say you're tracking the age when someone dies, or let's say you're tracking the annual income of someone, you will look in there and I guarantee you, you know, 5 times out of 10, you're going to see something crazy where someone earns quadrillions of dollars because someone copied and pasted something or something like that. And this is, you know, this is where it comes in, that the data is trying to lie to you in certain aspects. So do not trust the data at any point. I think Justin would probably agree with me on this one. It's a great story that he tells. I absolutely recommend that you read it. And I also definitely recommend that you don't trust any kind of data that comes to you.
I mean, see, what I like about this is that, so there's always sort of this like interplay, right, between domain experts, like people who really understand a particular field, like, or some process that's generating the data, and then the data experts, like the data scientists, who then process that information and look for answers that maybe would have been difficult for an individual to find based on their intuition, right? Sort of classic setup. I love that this really puts the blame on the domain experts and keeps it well away from the data scientists. This is what I like. Because if there's a problem, you can bet that it is not the fault of the data scientist process. It's the fault of whatever crap you gave us in the first place.
that's exactly my code always runs. And if there's any kind of problem, it's with you.
Absolutely. And speaking of things that you should not trust, That's a horrible lead into this because it's about the police. I take it back. I was trying to send that another way. Like, don't trust criminals. But in fact, what I was set up to say was, you should trust the police. They're there for your best interest. Number five, double whammy, data science in police work. Police who are our friends. All right. So this is actually a two-parter, which is both of these are super cool. So Juliana Reyes at Technically Philly gives an overview of some work done by the Southeast Pennsylvania Transit Authority, SEPTA. So basically, it's like the transit authority for Philadelphia and that part of the state. This is cool, right? So what we're sort of seeing a lot, right, at police stations around the country is that in the same way that data journalists have been looking to have been using sort of data investigation as part of their investigative process, what you're seeing at police departments around the country is that people like detectives, like people who do actual investigation, are also starting to turn to approaches for investigating data as part of their whatever, like investigating some real world immediate emergency, like a murder or something, or some kind of a crime. And so Juliana's story at Technically Philly is about these cops turned data scientists. Like, so basically they work their normal patrol, but then they got a grant for doing some extra work a couple nights a week doing crime mapping. And then so that the quote from their police chief is awesome. Violent crimes like murder, rape, and aggravated assault, which all fall under this police department's jurisdiction, are down 25% from last year, largely based on the data-driven investigations that they've been doing, which is fantastic, right? Because we sort of think of data science as this kind of nerdy thing, kind of off in the clouds. Maybe we'd, you know, improve our marketing ROI or whatever. But this is people who already do investigative work, just applying those techniques to data sets and actually having real-world outcomes, like reducing the number of people that are assaulted, which is kind of fantastic. And so the second part of this is that there was a really cool hackathon over the weekend called the Bayes Impact Hackathon, and it was in San Francisco. You should check it out. Again, like, we'll post the link. But there was a guy called Sean Taylor, who's a data scientist at Facebook, and he led a volunteer team, and they did a project called Out for Justice, which was in the running for best project at this hackathon. And basically, they were optimizing police patrols, right? So they were looking to figure out how police patrols could be more effective in sort of less time by choosing the neighborhoods or choosing the paths that would be the best for them to follow. So, like, it's, again, like, super interesting work. It's taking this concept of big data both to optimize, like, the operations of a police force and then sort of paired with the sort of more straightforward data science investigation that detectives are doing. And it really is, like, it's revolutionizing the way that we do law enforcement in this country. It's super exciting.
Yeah, I mean, what I loved about this story is, despite our wonderful jests about domain experts in the last story, this is a great, great, great case where, you know, it highlights a thing that I think both B and you absolutely believe, that the future of data science doesn't so much lie with us, but lies with domain experts. Right? So cops are experts in crime. They're experts in their, you know, their beats or whatever. Now I'm trying to use crime, you know, classic cop talk.
Hard-boiled Chris Albert talks
walking
about.
Walking the street. But cops are experts in their, you know, in their expertise and in their the data that they end up producing, but they might not be experts in using that data, right? Understanding what's happening. And I really believe that with a, you know, moderate amount of training, not a PhD in something, but some kind of professional training in using data science or partnerships with data scientists through something like Bayes Impact or Datakind, we can see great improvements in decision makings by these domain experts, right? They are not ignorant to making great decisions. They produce a lot of data a lot of times, but understanding that data is just not something that is part of their traditional training. So incorporating that, even at a moderate level, can have and has been shown to have a huge difference in producing great outcomes, right? And those outcomes happen because those domain experts have questions that they want. They have the data to answer those questions. It's just making that connection between them, who knows what's happening, and the data that they produce to help them create data-driven decisions. And, you know, I've always had a problem with the idea of pure data driven, right? As if, like, you know, if a crime reaches over 25%, you'll change some kind of police patrol or something like that. But I think showing that to people who are domain experts can help them decide what they want to do with the data in a really great way. And I love projects that are helping domain experts gain that knowledge to work with the data that, that they own, their own data.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what's going on, which is it's just really exciting. So that there's no longer this gap like you're talking about between or there's no longer this disconnect, which is I think ultimately fundamentally false, right? This disconnect between, well, normally I make decisions based on my intuition, which is only a data-driven decision based on the data that you're able to acquire and filter based on your years of knowledge and expertise, right? That's all that means. Like, it's just a different kind of data processing. And so when we're talking about doing it more intentionally or explicitly or with the aid of technology, like, that's very similar to the process that domain experts already undergo. And so the marrying of these two things, like putting data science tools in the hands of these experts, is really, I think, like you're saying, it really represents the most interesting frontier. I mean, as much as we're excited about like artificial intelligence and like self-driving cars and all of that stuff is great, but like the sort of the day-to-day practical change that we'll see in the near future, I think, is exactly this kind of work.
No, absolutely. So. All right, number six, when Fitbit is the expert witness. This is a story coming from Kate Crawford from The Atlantic. Now, in the story, she talks about a personal trainer who was injured on the job. And then she has gone to court 4 years later and is using Fitbit data to show that her activity levels are lower than what someone who was her age and profession should be, right? So she's taking her own Fitbit data and using it to prove that she has been injured previously on the job. 4 years down the line. Now, it's not the data that interests me. There's so many cool things that you can do with Fitbit data. And I don't own a Fitbit, but I've always kind of wanted one. So, you know.
You're just putting that out there.
If anyone out there has a spare Fitbit, send it my way.
You know, Christmas is coming up. And
But it's not the data. It's rather the specifics of this case. So she's not using the raw Fitbit data to prove that she has a work injury. Rather, she's given that data to a private company, which is using an analysis, where I'm guessing, you know, I'm going to assume some kind of algorithm to compare her Fitbit data with the general population's Fitbit data. And this is where it becomes really, really interesting, because she is in court paying a private company to use an algorithm to prove that she has, I mean, technically I think they're supposed to be independent, but the idea behind this is that she's paying them and they're going to come to court and say, yes, based on our analysis, she is not able to perform or is not performing like people of her age and profession should be. And it, you know, when we look at that, that is something that I think we're going to see more and more of, which is discussions not so much on the data, but on the algorithms that are used to produce the results, right? So the difference between action and data is an algorithm almost all the time. And, you know, in this case, we see it very explicitly. This company's algorithm is going to be the thing that determines how this court case plays out, probably. And, you know, what is that algorithm? Is it public? Is it not public? This is things that we don't know yet. And I think it's really, really interesting to see how this particular court case plays out, where, you know, it's these kind of algorithms are starting to determine real things in people's lives. And that's an awesome point. And, you know, I am really, really interested to see in the future which way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to carry on from that, actually, right? Like, so if let's say that they come up with an algorithm that determines that she should be paid out like millions of dollars, right, based on her work injury that they've been able to prove through their algorithm. Like, at that point, in order to prove it, you need to explain something really abstract and complex to a non-technical audience, right? Like, you're sort of back in that situation where how do you tell a story with some kind of data-driven analysis? How do you tell a story based on the fact that a series of instructions that you gave to a computer to perform some fairly complex math produced a result that is in favor of one person or another, and like real money hangs in the balance, and like a probably non-technical person is going to be the arbiter of whether or not that's true? You know, that's super interesting, because like the burden on everybody involved now to tell the story that comes out of that analysis is super high.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, when I read stuff like this, More and more, I can't help but think back to when DNA evidence started to be introduced into the court system. And you would have these lawyers really trying to explain to a jury something that's highly scientific, right? And now, you know, this DNA has become, or this use of DNA and evidence has become something that's really, really general, and it's used all the time. In fact, I can't name the daytime TV show, but there is that daytime TV show, let's say Jerry Springer, which is famous for having, you know, you are the father, you are not the father. So, you know, it's become part of the societal knowledge, not the specifics of it, but that these things work. And I'll be interested to see how algorithms start to be incorporated in that, just like how the science behind data science or behind genetic science was done the same.
This is going to be so amazing. There's going to be like CSI data science edition. It's going to be like rapid cutaways and like super urgent people clicking with mouses.
I'm already applying for hackers. That. I'm going to send in my B-roll, me running in a suit through some warehouses.
Totally like collecting pieces of paper and running them through a scanner so that you're going to, all right. Just give me a minute. Like, we're going to digitize this and it's going to be amazing. All right. So carrying directly on from that in a way that is absolutely not related whatsoever. Number seven article this week. Comet 1, butt 0. That's the main takeaway from this article. So basically, I can only assume that everybody has heard about these two huge things that happened on the internet. One, Kim Kardashian posed, we'll just say nude, I guess, for a magazine called Paper. They had this whole campaign to break the internet, and they were going to break the internet because presumably everybody would be so excited about Kim Kardashian posing nude that they would like forward this cover around all over the place. The other story that may or may not be as significant, but it also happened, so I feel like I should bring it up, was that we landed a spaceship on a moving comet. This also occurred, and I... And so what Taylor Umloff and Rani Mala at the Wall Street Journal's Speakeasy blog did, so they basically sucked in a bunch of Twitter data because they were also concerned by the fact that these two probably not analogous events, or like these two events that probably shouldn't have the same amount of importance in our global consciousness, were competing with each other for airtime, basically, like competing for people's bandwidth and attention. So what's more interesting to the world, Kim Kardashian's butt or sending a spaceship from Earth to land on a moving comet? And it turns out after they sucked in a bunch of Twitter data that people were more interested in the comet. So whether or not you were personally more interested in the comet, you can take pride in being part of the human race because we were more interested as a species in the fact that we landed on a comet in space and that was cool than we were in a reality TV star mooning us. That's great. There's not like a big data science component to this. This is just like some people at the Wall Street Journal used a very small amount of data science to prove something that makes me feel better about myself as a human being, and that's why it's on the list.
No.
So there you go.
Well, if you were one of the people who helped contribute to science winning over Kim Kardashian's behind, thank you so much because you restored my faith in humanity that science should always be on top. So, you know, this is a great story because it makes me feel good about our society in general. Congratulations, yeah. Science, you won.
Pour one out for the comet tweeters. <That's>
what... Absolutely.
You saved us all.
All right. Story number 8. Outlier pollsters cheated themselves in Virginia Senate race. So this comes from... Nate Silver, the famous data guy from 538.
Who's that? Does he like have a blog or something?
He has a book. Barely remember him. So the very famous Nate Silver came out with a really great story in the last few days about a particular Senate race that happened in Virginia. Now, in this Senate race, a huge number of polls, the vast majority of polls, showed that a Democrat called Mark Warner had an insurmountable lead over the Republican, who's called Ed Gillespie. Now, in all these polls, which are multiples, he had a high single-digit or low double-digit lead, right? So he's basically somewhere around 10% above. That's a huge margin in politics.
Yeah.
It turned out at the end that Warner, the Democrat, won by less than a single percent. So less than a very, very small number. I think it was something like, you know, millions of votes. It was like 16,000 votes or something like that. So that's incredibly small. And no one caught it. And there was a lot of news stories in the last week about why all these polls were totally wrong, because those polls absolutely affected how Mark Warner ran his campaign, because he thought he was in the lead. He thought he had it. He thought he was probably wrapped it up. And he did win at the end, but he barely won. So, you know, the thing that Nate Silver brings up is this really cool story that at least one pollster actually had the correct data, right? So this one pollster had the race as a tie in their polls. So that was the result that came out. But they didn't publish it. And they didn't publish it not because they believed their methodology was wrong, not because they had some great reason to believe their you know, what kind of analysis was wrong or their data was wrong or anything like that. They actually didn't release it for, here's a quote from the article, that the pollster told me that he didn't publish the poll because he thought people would dismiss it as an outlier and attack his company as inaccurate. Now, this is what's so amazing from this, is that the Gravis, which is the company that did it, had this data in hand, and they did not release the results because purely social reasons, right? They did not want to seem like, oh, these guys are crazy. They don't have, you know, they're totally different from everyone else. And that is, you know, I get it. This happens, and I get this happens a lot in pollster, you know, in the world of polling, that people kind of spike their poll when it's totally crazy off to the side because they don't want to seem like it. But they had it. They absolutely had the result. And you know, the difference between them and everyone else is everyone else was incredibly biased in one direction to the point that it affected a political election, except for this one polling company. And they spiked their own poll, which is so crazy to me. But, I can see that kind of societal, or not the societal, but that professional pressure on these guys to not be the crazy ones. But they had it. They absolutely had it. They had the exact results. That's just amazing to me. And I love, it's a really cool story. And I recommend that everyone check it out.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's interesting is, like, so, you know, if you're like the Chicken Little polling company, like, it would have been disregarded, right? Like, there's no, even if they, what's interesting is that, like, A, they didn't release it for exactly the reasons that you're saying, because they would have been laughed at, basically. They would have been dismissed. And so what's the point of even releasing it? And that's the thing. Had they said, no, everybody else is wrong, we have the real data, look at our poll, unless they were some major national media publication that has enough weight to sort of go toe-to-toe with a lot of different polling companies, there's no way that they would have been taken seriously. So it would have been pointless, although I guess they would today have the benefit of saying, I told you so, which would be cool. But you know what I mean? Like, we definitely have a herd mentality. Like, maybe it's for the reasons that we've been talking about. Like, everybody trusts that the data is the data. The data must be accurate. And so anybody who doesn't come to the same conclusion from the data must be wrong, as opposed to saying the process is the process and my data might be actually better than yours.
No, it's absolutely true. And I think it's particularly true in polling. So for those who don't know, polling, particularly political polling, is very, very difficult. It is not a straightforward process. There are so many variables that can affect your results, the data you produce, all that kind of stuff, whether it's raining, the type of people that you hire to conduct the polls, your policy for like where they can stand, if they have a clipboard versus an iPad, there's like what the ordering of your questions. There are so many different ways that you can affect the poll results. And, you know, it is a credit to these polling organizations that they get it as accurate as they get it all the time, because it is not a simple, straightforward thing. In this particular case, the vast majority of them got it wrong, and one guy or one company got it right. However, he was, you know, he just didn't trust his own process, which is, you know, it's unfortunate. I kind of wish they would just release whatever they produced and, you know, let me be the judge of that.
Yeah, well, hopefully that'll be the way it is in the future. Or maybe, you know, if enough people are starting to become aware of data science or have some kind of, you know, more casual relationship with data-driven decision-making, data analyses, then, you know, we'll all be a little more suspect or a little bit more willing to consider what looks like an outlier initially in this kind of situation, right?
Absolutely.
And so, and that's actually why I brought up my number nine.
Number nine.
Story number nine is because for people who are either practitioners already, or if you're sort of just getting into data science, maybe you have a little bit of a programming background, and you are interested in the actual analysis, maybe some kind of machine learning or natural language processing or some kind of statistical analysis, but you don't want to get into the whole big data universe because they really are two separate things. Like we talked about last week, there's big data, which is taking, you know, lots of data and extracting all of the important features, like extracting the bits of information that you need in order to do the analysis, which is step two. And if you want to focus on a data set that's small enough where you don't have to deal with the big data machinery like Hadoop and Spark and whatever, there's a data scientist called Darius Kazemi, and he's released a great project on GitHub called Corpora, which is the plural of corpus, which is what you call a data set that you're going to use to in some kind of analysis. So if you are a little bit technically minded, if you have really any programming experience at all, it's fairly easy to get started and start chugging your way through it. These are very manageable data sets. They're interesting. Like there's kind of novel things to discover in them. So I encourage everybody to go check out Darius's GitHub repo. You can find it on our website and get started. Knock yourself out. Do some data science so that you can be the one that calls out the polling company that doesn't release their poll numbers. Because go for it, guys. Give it a shot.
No, this is like really, this is a really cool thing. And Darius has done something that I think a lot of us have kind of wanted to see for a while, which is these little teeny data sets of things that might be useful to us. So I looked at one, which was all the different types of sandwiches that someone had came up with. So I had like a BLT and like, you know, five times of cheese sandwiches and that kind of stuff. And, you know, this is kind of cool because there's times down the line where someone wants to do an analysis and it requires, let's say, all the type of sandwiches, whatever kind of analysis that is, or lots of different first names or something like that, right? Some kind of set of data to run their analysis the way they think it should be run. And that's where Corpora can do so well, is to sort of be that repo with those small sets of data for people to use, right? We don't need a huge infrastructure to make sure we have all the different sandwich types. But it is kind of cool to have them just listed out, and, you know, not only for people to use it to learn basic data science, but also for people who have these projects that might want to, you know, use this information as some kind of index or some kind of, you know, some kind of filter to work on their own, let's say, more complicated data, but to take these little parts of it and work with it. That's so cool. I'm super jealous that he's come up with this.
Well, yeah. And then as a side note, as some additional benefit to that, if you're not a data science practitioner or don't have aspirations to be a data science practitioner, there is a list of every type of dinosaur known to humankind.
That's amazing.
That you can go and read, because why would you not want that information?
Absolutely.
Like, sure, yeah, Tyrannosaurus. Yeah, everybody's heard of Tyrannosaurus, the Velociraptor. We all saw Jurassic Park. But have you heard of an Acrocanthosaurus? Neither had I. Neither had I until right now. So go check it out. And big props to Davis.
Yeah, that's great. So ending our number 10 on another lighthearted story, Paul Downey at his blog has started a really cool project, which I kind of wish I'd love to see people do more. But, maybe through highlighting his efforts, we'll spark some people to do it, including ourselves. So what Paul has done is he's taken a single data set, in this case, the price paid for property in the land registry, which I'm guessing is the UK land registry, but we'll see. And for the next month, he is going through and doing 30 different analyses and visualizations on a single data set. And this is so cool because he's taking a small set of data and he's hammering at it at every different angle imaginable, right? So, you know, one time he's going to do a heat map and then a bar chart and then, you know, tackle the price correlated with whatever the location and then the price correlated with the buyer's demographics or something like that, all within a single data set. And, you know, we talked so much this week about how don't trust the algorithms, don't trust the data, right? These are things that you have to really understand before you can judge what's happening. But in this case, he's actually doing exactly how you should be doing it on an extreme scale, right? He's taking a data set where the first times he runs an analysis on it, he's going to understand a little bit about the variables that are in that data set. But man, 30 days in, after 30 analyses, he's really going to understand how that data set behaves, and he's going to be able to do cool stuff with it. And I love the idea of using with it. I think it's a great way for people to learn data science, to take a data set that they know, so they're not both learning data science and the data itself, and just really hammer on it over and over and over again, trying to do everything they can, extract every single cool part about some moderate or small size data set, and really enjoying themselves. And I kind of wish I was doing it right now. Maybe I'll do it in December. And, you know, it's a cool project. I think it's cool. I wish we did it as, you know, I wish we did it as part of training in data science. And, you know, it's cool.
Yeah. And plus, I think if he were interested in investing in some real estate in the UK, he would potentially be in a pretty good position to do that.
Be well situated, as it were.
No, that's cool. It's a great project. I think that's actually a really good point to bring up, is that a difficult hurdle to get over as you're first getting into some basic data analyses is that you have to have some kind of data to work with. And in order to know whether what you did produced a meaningful outcome, you have to be pretty familiar with the data set. So, you know, a lot of times you'll find that the complicated algorithms for analyzing some data, or like the real, the calculus behind it, right? The difficult math behind it has all been abstracted away. Like there's some library in Python or R or whatever, and you call a method into the library and you input an array of data and out pops like a beautiful chart that plausibly could be based on something real, or maybe it's just a line. Like you have no idea, right? Because like you don't actually, at least for me, I don't really understand all of the intricacies of the math behind the method that I'm calling. And so if you don't understand the data set and you can't sort of intuitively know what should pop out at the end, the learning process is really difficult, because it's a little bit like you're wandering around in the dark because you don't know, you're taking actions, but you don't know whether the consequences are meaningful. So this kind of project is great. I think, especially like you're saying, if you're interested in honing your skills and really digging into a data science problem and understanding what the mechanics are.
Yeah, no, I think you made the great point where, you know, data is complicated and data science is complicated. And if you really want to focus on one, you should leave the other one constant, right? And in this case, he's leaving the data set constant. He really is going to get to know that one data set. And then from there, he can, you know, do what he wants and really focus on learning the other things. And if he produces a result that's weird in this particular case, he'll be able to see that it is weird because he understands the data set. And that's cool. It's awesome. Kudos to him.
Yeah, it's a cool project. I'm glad I got to hear about it.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Come back next week for more data science, data topics, and drinking. Credit for the music for today goes to Professor Click, who you'll hear at the beginning and the end. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at PartiallyD and visit us at partiallyderivative.com. You can also follow me at Chris Albin and my co-host, Jonathan Morgan, at Jonathan Morgan.
Thanks for listening.
Have a good week.